Okay, please sit down. Okay. Okay. Welcome back. So now we are going to do some questions and so we'll see what happens, what comes up. So these are apparently all questions on karma and rebirth. So let's see what this is. Please explain how you are reborn. Is it the moment you die or otherwise? Chuta chitta, right, okay. Which is the death moment, the mind moment when you die, the chuta chitta. Okay, thank you, Bandhasura, etc. May blessings and triple gen be with you. This is one of those controversial topics. Exactly when does rebirth happen? And the traditional viewpoint in the Theravada, Theravada Buddhism, this is in accordance with the commentaries, in accordance with, later scriptures, is that you are reborn immediately here. I'm not sure myself if that is the case. There are many different schools of Buddhism. Many different schools arose, and some of the different schools thought that there is something called the intermediate state, the Antarabhava, and that there is an intermediate state. There was one school of Buddhists called the, what were they called again now? The anyway, there was at least one school, probably many schools of Buddhists. The Sotrantikas, that's right, the Sotrantikas, which were the Sutta school of Buddhists, they said there is an Antarabhava, there's a time in between before you take rebirth. And I must admit, when I read the Suttas of the Buddha, to me, this is only my personal opinion, but it seems to me that there is such a thing as an intermediate state. That's how it looks to me. That's how it seems to me, how the Buddha taught. There's many, many reasons for that. There's many different passages in the suttas. That's what it looks like. I don't know if it really matters all that much. You have the feeling when you die, you go on. Sometimes if you have a very powerful karma, say that you have, been into some very profound meditation, right? Because the meditation is so profound, sometimes you just get reborn straight away in the Brahma Loka. Or perhaps if you have some extremely bad karma, and then you may actually be reborn directly in a bad destination. I think it also depends on the type of karma you have. There's many, many factors involved in this. I also think that some of the modern day evidence that we have, like near-death experiences, anecdotal evidence, I think they also, if we are to believe that the modern day near-death experience are a real perception of what happens when you die, then I think that is also evidence that there is an Antarabhava, right? You have the feeling when you die, you go out of your body, and then sometimes there's a sense that there is a barrier. If you go beyond that, you cannot come back again, right? So once you go beyond that barrier, that's like a rebirth, and then before that is possibly then similar to the Antarabhava. Anyway, so that is how it looks to me. I think in the end, it probably doesn't make all that much difference for how we practice, whether it is Antarabhava or not. Okay, Reverend Bhante, after one's death, this is the same thing, according to the Chula Chitta, I guess next rebirth, which is neither me nor someone else. How can one's previous practices condition the present rebirth? How can one's previous practices condition the present birth? Please make me understand. Taranang Saranai, okay. What we are today, the person you are now, whether you are a Buddhist, whether your meditation is peaceful or not, all of these things depend on what you have done in the past, right? So everything you are now is a product of the past. So in a sense, if you have done the right things in the past life, practice in the right way, it becomes relatively more easy to practice in the right way in this life. And the same thing, if you do all the right things in this life, then it becomes relatively more easy to continue doing the right thing in the future life. So all of these things condition each other. So all of these previous practices from the past would obviously be very important and very influential in this life. One of the things that I think is important, we often talk about karma and rebirth, and we often think about that come, you know, the rebirth we have now is a result of the karma in the past, or our future rebirth is a result of the karma that we are doing in this life. But remember that karma is also about how we experience this life. You do karma now, and the results appear also in this life. Right? The Buddha says that there are three types of results of karma. You do action, and you experience the result here and now. You do action, you experience it in the next life, and you do actions, you experience in future lives beyond that. So it can come at any time, but it can also happen in this life. And that, of course, is very useful. So what does it mean that karma, that we experience karma in this life? And one way of looking at that, which I think is very, very useful, and I would probably recommend all of you to do that, is to feel your actions. When you act, when you do something, in particular when you do something which is colored by a sense of kindness, or perhaps by a sense of anger or ill will, or by some desire or whatever it is, when the mind is colored by something which has ethical significance in that sense, there is an intention of a certain type, then feel what that feels like. It's actually a very powerful way of understanding your mind and to understand how karma actually works. And you will find, this is what I find in myself, if I do something kind, if I do something good, then straight away the mind feels better. You feel brightness. You feel a sense of gladness. You feel that the mind is kind of, you're cutting some of the loads which is holding the mind down and allowing the mind to soar. And you can feel that in the present moment. And to me, that is the most powerful way of understanding the karma in the present life. And when you see that, when you see the effect that your action has on your mind right away, it becomes a very powerful incentive to practice more. So notice that. Or you do something which isn't quite right. Right? You do something, you say something, it isn't quite nice. Sometimes you just have a thought, not a very nice thought. What does it feel like? And what it feels like is like your energy is depleted, right? Your energy gets drawn down. You feel inside of you, you can feel the direct and immediate consequence of your actions. So please notice that. When you feel that, you can start to understand why it is that our actions must have consequences, right? Because we are building ourselves, building our personality. And that is something that we will take with us into the future, of course. So the more you do of that, the more of the energy you build up inside of yourself, then the more of an energetic mind and a happy mind are you taking with you into the future life as well. The more you deplete yourself of energy, the more darkness you create inside of yourself because of bad acts, you are kind of moving forwards into a similar kind of state also in future lives. In this way, you can actually almost feel the effect of karma right away. I think that is a very, very useful way of looking at karma and rebirth. To make it practical, the Buddhist path is supposed to be a practical path. It's about how to live, how to make sure things go in the right direction. So make these teachings practical, right? Then they become so much more powerful rather than just being theoretical things. Okay. If our lives are controlled by karma, then does it mean that the past birth past birth and actions were controlled by previous birth actions, then we don't have any control to do anything good or bad. Okay, so the question here is, how is life deterministic? Are we controlled by karma? Everything we do, going back to infinity, is it all kind of controlled by karma? And the answer is no. The Buddha says quite specifically that our lives are not controlled by karma. How we live, how we experience the world is conditioned by a large number of things, and karma is only one of those. The Buddha says specifically that if you feel happiness and pleasure in this life, right? If you go into the street and you trip in the curb, now is that because of karma, or is it just because you're not being mindful? Or maybe you're being mindful, but you're being mindful in the wrong place, right? And because of that, that's why you're tripping. And the Buddha says these kind of accidents have got nothing to do with karma. It's just ordinary things happening in life, right? The Buddha even says even illnesses often have got nothing to do with karma. It's just that you happen to become ill, right? And if that illness then leads to death, again, it is not necessarily anything to do with karma. So karma is only one factor. Karma is only one thing. And the Buddha specifically says in the sutta that if everything was due to karma, there would be no escape from samsara. We would be trapped because we're just following this program and there would be no way out of it. But because there are also other causes and conditions, one of those incredibly important cause and condition in our life is the teachings of the Buddha. This is the most powerful of all the cause and conditions. And you know, there is a, I like to say that, I say this all the time, but it's a nice thing to say anyway. And there is this beautiful sutta where Venerable Ananda goes to the Buddha. And Venerable Ananda, I'm sure you have heard about this, every one of you here. Venerable Ananda says to the Buddha, oh, you know, Bhagava, you know, Lord, the Kalyanamitta is 50% of the holy life, right? You know that sutta. And then the Buddha says, no, Ananda, that's not the case. Kalyanamitta is 100% of the holy life, right? And I remember when I first read that, I was thinking to myself, surely the Buddha is exaggerating. How can it be 100%? What about all the other things? Sila and generosity and kindness and metta and compassion and peace and wisdom and virya energy. What about all these other things? Are they nothing? How can Kalyanamitta be 100%? Then after a while, you read the suttas, you realize the Buddha doesn't usually exaggerate. Usually what he does is underplay things, right? He's a bit kind of, he kind of tends to underplay things rather than actually exaggerate things. And I realized he's absolutely serious. It is 100% of the holy life. Why is that? It is because that initial spark is required. Unless you hear something like the teaching of the Buddha, unless you get some truth from the outside, it is impossible that you shall actually find that truth for yourself. Maybe not entirely impossible, but extremely, extremely unlikely. And that is why Kalyanamitta is 100% of the holy life. Without that, you will just fare on according to cause and conditions. And the one cause and condition that you need, which is the word of the Buddha, you're not getting it, so that nothing ever gets started. So this actually is, is actually one of the, I think, very important things, and important to understand that in the right way. And once you understand that, you start to think, wow, maybe I should read the suttas, right? If Kalyanamitta is everything, and the Buddha is the highest Kalyanamitta, I should maybe read what he said. Sometimes people think that the suttas are too profound, too difficult to read, I can't understand what's going on. But many of the suttas in the Pali Canon are addressed to ordinary people, just like us, right? Even if you're not a professional, as a monk, we're supposed to be professionals, right? But even if you're not a professional, still, it is addressed to ordinary people like everybody here today. And one of the things that I always like to remind myself of as a Buddhist, as a monastic, is that when the Buddha taught these suttas 2,500 years ago, remember, he was setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma Chakka Pavattana, right? So what does that mean? What that means is that he knew the Dhamma would be lasting, would be going on in the world for a long, long time in the future. That's what he knew, right? So he knew that when he gave these teachings, I have to give them in such a way that they are understandable also for future generations. Also for people who live in completely different culture, right? I'm kind of half Australian, half Norwegian now. I've been living in Australia for so long. So when I go back to Norway, I'm not sure if I feel at home anymore. If I go to Australia, I don't feel at home either. I'm kind of homeless, which is just right for a Buddhist monk. And he knew that, people like that, he explains it to people with any kind of background so that we are able to understand it. And this is the powerful thing when you read the word of the Buddha. You feel that this teaching, which transcends culture, transcends time, transcends space, and it's true for everybody. It goes to the heart of any kind of person, wherever you go. So the Buddha, when he gave these teachings 2,500 years ago, he had us in mind, right? He was thinking about us. He was deliberately putting his message in such a way. He wasn't thinking about literally this hall. They probably wouldn't know that this hall would be here and we would be sitting here. But he knew that there would be people like us sitting together, listening to the Dhamma or reading his book 2,500 years ago. He knew that. So in a very literal sense, he was teaching us. He had us in mind. Right? When I think of that, I feel it's so powerful. When I think that the Buddha actually was thinking about me and each one of you here, it's kind of a very, very powerful thing. And the message, you know, the compassionate message of the Buddha, wanting us to be happy, wanting us to be free of suffering, is directly directed at us. We are direct disciples of the Buddha. Once you start to read the suttas, that's what you become. So please read the suttas. Please get a feeling for these teachings for yourself. And if you don't understand, you can ask someone who understands more than you. Okay. Bhante, in the beginning of meditation process, when trying to be in the present moment, the mind wanders continuously from past incidents to future plans. You mentioned about no willpower. I would like to know how to let go of this past and future incident without any control or willpower. Please advise. Okay. If you use willpower in the meditation, the mind wanders even more into the past and future. This is the problem. Initially, you may feel like you can control things and you are in charge of the mind, you can control it into the present moment, right? That's what it feels like. But actually, willpower, there's two things about willpower. The first thing, it is not very pleasant when you force the mind, right? Because it's not very pleasant when you force the mind after a while tends to rebel. And the mind rebels, it goes into the future, into the past, into fantasies and all these kind of things. So willpower is counterproductive. So the mind does that. So the mind doesn't want to be in the present moment. And remember that the reason why the mind is wandering into the past and the future in the first place is because of the will, right? It's the will that makes the mind go into the future and the past. The mind doesn't go into the future and the past by itself. It's not as if the mind is this automatic thing which just goes into the future and the past. It's because you want to think about the future, because you want to think about the past. That's why it goes there. This is quite difficult to see. It takes a very profound mindfulness and often samadhi to be able to see these things, because it is at the very deep level of the mind, right? And that is why the idea of not using willpower is so powerful. Because by not using willpower, you are taking away that thing which actually drives the mind into the future and into the past in the first place. It is the willpower which makes you think about the future. It's the willpower that makes you think about the past. So this is the idea with present moment awareness, right? Present moment awareness, no control, just being passively in the present. If you can do that 100%, then the mind will no longer move into the past and into the future. So this is the whole idea behind this. So that is why you often start the meditation, or not start, but after a while, you get into the present moment awareness. So this is the first thing, right? If you use willpower, it's counterproductive. We want to do the exact opposite, to withdraw the willpower. And the second thing is the thing I was talking about, happiness, right? Feeling a sense of joy. Sometimes it doesn't have to be a very profound sense of happiness. Sometimes, as I was saying, it can just be a sense of you are sitting back and you're just saying, wow, how nice it is to be here, right? There's nothing I have to do. There is no chores in my life. There's no work. I can just relax and just enjoy the present moment. And sometimes something very simple like that can be enough to draw you into the present moment. Because happiness, that sort of happiness, the happiness which really is a spiritual type of happiness, that happiness is right here in the present moment. And the mind becomes mindful as a consequence of that. So you withdraw the willpower and then you find the happiness. This is why happiness is so important. This is why sila is so important. Sila is in the end what drives the happiness. And you can see how everything comes together in a very beautiful way. This is an important thing that when you read the suttas, you have to understand that sometimes, you know, you hear about the different aspects, you hear about, you know, the five faculties, the Noble Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, dependent originations, the Bhujangas, the Khandas, and all these kind of things. But actually, it all belongs together in one picture. And you have to understand how it all fits together very beautifully. And the more you understand that, and this is also what you get from reading the suttas, the more you understand that, you start to see how this whole process happens as a consequence of right practice. Okay. Reverend Sir, you said we act like robots or puppets due to our conditioning. How can we steer ourselves away from negative conditioning? Yes, we are robots. And again, this is why the idea of Kalyanamitta is so important, right? Why the idea of the Buddha is so important? Because the Buddha is that one condition which conditions your robot in a different direction. So you're putting in a new program, right? The Dhamma, you put in the Dhamma instead. And you may have heard, I'm sure many of you will know about my teacher, Ajahn Brahm. And he has this famous simile for the idea of non-self. This is really all about non-self, really. Understanding non-self in a practical way. And he has this simile of non-self, which is called the driverless bus simile, right? And the driverless bus is that you are sitting on this bus, and you're looking out the window, right? And this bus is kind of driving along. And sometimes you look out the window, and it's beautiful outside. And you feel so happy because it's beautiful. Other times you look out the window, it's terrible. It's like rubbish dumps and kind of toxic wastelands or whatever. It's terrible. You don't want to look, but you have to look because that's where you are. Then you feel a lot of suffering as a consequence. And then after a while, this is how Ajahn Brahm explains this simile. After a while you wonder, why is this bus taking me to all these weird places? I don't want to go to these toxic waste dumps and these rubbish tips or whatever. I want to see the nice stuff all the time, the lakes and the mountains and the forests and the sea. I want to see that all the time, the beautiful nature in the world. So then you decide you want to go up to the driver's seat, right? Check out the driver's seat. You're going to tell that bus driver off and tell him a piece of your mind. You stupid bus driver. Why are you doing all these bad things? And so you go up to the bus driver. And then you find the seat is empty. There's nobody there. That's the simile of the bus driver, right? And then because the seat is empty, you understand that you have no choice. You just have to go back to your seat. And you just have to endure the difficult times you have to endure. And the good times you enjoy moderately, not too much. Because if you enjoy too much, you attach. And the suffering becomes stronger when the suffering comes around, right? So that is Ajahn Brahm's simile of the bus. But I want to add to that simile. This is very cheeky. I'm Ajahn Brahm's disciple, and I'm going to add to my teacher's simile, right? So please don't tell Ajahn Brahm about this. He may I don't see what he will say here. Anyway, I'm sure he won't mind, actually. But the idea is, it is true that it's empty here. But it is being run on a program. And that program it is run on is partly all the conditioning from your past. That is what decides where you are going. So what you want to do, instead of having an empty seat there, you want to place the Buddha in that seat, right? That's what we want to do. You want to put the Dhamma in that seat. So what you do is that you go back home and you get the four Nikayas, right? Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Sanyutta Nikaya, and Anguttara Nikaya, and you put those in the driver's seat. That's what you place there. And then, if you do that, what happens is that the bus starts to go in a slightly different direction. It goes to more of the beautiful places. You see more nice scenery, right? Sometimes you still see the trash, the big dumps of rubbish dumps or whatever. Sometimes you see the toxic waste dumps. But more and more you see the beautiful stuff, and less you see the bad stuff. But then the strange thing, and this is where you have to be careful, the very strange thing happens, is that sometimes the Buddha says, you should do this. And you say, no, don't want to do it. Don't want to do it. You're asking too much, right? Sometimes you just can't practice the Dhamma. You feel it's asking too much. So then you get off the bus, right? And allow the bus to continue. And then you think, wait a minute, maybe who is right here? Is the Buddha right or am I right? And after a while you realize you made a mistake. And then you get on the bus again and you continue. This is what life is like sometimes when the Buddha is in the driver's seat. Is that sometimes we're not able to live up to those high standards that the Buddha asked for us. We get off the bus. And then eventually, we're talking about stream entry, I think they call it Sovan here in Sri Lanka, that is when you are on the bus full time. Before that, we're kind of going on and off a little bit. So that is how it works, right? So it is in a sense conditioned, but you allow the Buddha to recondition you. You allow the Dhamma to recondition you. That's why you understand the importance of listening to Dhamma talks, the importance of reading the suttas, the importance of reflecting on the suttas. So it actually moves you in the right direction. When you understand that, because what you're doing is you're building up this new driver. You're making a new driver in the bus. And this driver takes you to a nice location. That's the point. Okay. How do we initiate meditation? How can we build up mindfulness prior to watching the breath? Okay, so again, you have to understand the causes of mindfulness, right? And the causes that take you away from mindfulness. So what are the things that take you away from mindfulness? Basically the five hindrances, right? The pancha nivarana are the main thing that takes you away from mindfulness. So, for example, in ordinary life, because people these days are so busy everywhere, one of the things that you find is that you are tired. If you are tired, mindfulness is not going to work. So one of the ways of allowing the mind to become mindful is to allow yourself enough rest, right? Especially to rest before meditation. So if you find that you are becoming tired in the meditation, don't fight the tiredness. If you fight the tiredness, you become even more tired because the fighting itself tires out the mind. So allow yourself, and then if you nod off a little bit, that's okay. I have some very good monastic friends who are very, very good meditators. And one of these monastic friends, he says every time he sits down, and he's a good meditator, right? Every time he sits down, he kind of starts off like this. Nodding, right? Nodding away. And everybody thinks, what a lousy meditator. He's nodding all the time, like this all the time. But no, he's actually a very good meditator. But when you are busy during the day, the mind feels naturally tired. So you allow the mind to rest. He's not fighting. He's just allowing the mind to rest by nodding a little bit. And then after the mind regains its energy, mindfulness comes back, right? So you should do something similar. Don't fight the tiredness. Don't try to get rid of it. The right way to get rid of the tiredness is by allowing the mind to rest. And this is what you are doing in this particular place. That is number one. That is number one problem. Number two problem is that the mind is restless, right? You've been doing a lot of stuff, and because of that, the mind is running around and is restless, going this way and that way, and doesn't really want to settle down. Again, because it is just a habit of the mind, you have to allow the mind time to kind of settle down. And this is what present moment awareness is all about. This is what the idea of passive observation is all about. You're passively observing, you're standing back, and by withdrawing the willpower, by withdrawing the controller inside, always pushing you in meditation, the mind calms down by itself. Right? More and more. But it's gradual. It takes time. So you don't push these things. You don't use willpower. You just allow things to die down all by itself. What it takes, it's patience. This is why patience is said to be the highest spiritual quality, because it's very hard to be that patient. But that is what it takes. It just takes incredible amount of patience. You just have to wait. And as you wait, and as you are passively aware, as you have this kind of choiceless awareness, just allowing things to be, then things calm down all by themselves, very easily, slowly, slowly, slowly. So this is how you do that. This is how you overcome the obstacles, not by willpower, but by doing this. And then what you find is that mindfulness arises, right, as a consequence of that. But again, one more time, remember again, happiness, right? Not any kind of happiness, but spiritual happiness, the happiness that comes from having a good heart, the happiness that comes from being generous, the happiness that comes from metta, the happiness that comes from compassion, the happiness that comes from wisdom, the happiness that comes from recollecting the Buddha in the right way. These are what we call spiritual happiness, and they are different from the worldly happiness. And that spiritual happiness is what draws the mind into the present moment. Mindfulness arises as a consequence. And this is why I said before about the importance of sila. If you have a profound sense of morality in your life, in the mentally, but also by body and speech, the more you develop that, the more happiness you have in meditation practice. There is a very beautiful simile by the Buddha that I always like to talk about. I talk about it probably too much, but then again, the Buddha also repeated himself, so I don't feel too bad about that. And this is a beautiful simile by the Buddha, where the Buddha says that the idea of virtue, it is like this person. After a long day, you've been working really hard, you've been looking after your family, you've been doing all those things, right? And you feel quite tired. And then the evening time is time to go home and rest. These days we have television and computers, so you don't even get any rest in the evening, right? But at the time of the Buddha, you can actually rest in the evening. Yeah. That was one of the differences. So you go home and you rest. So you lie down, right? And you're kind of enjoying and just relaxing, sitting in your favorite armchair, right? Just closing your eyes. And when you do that, after the tiredness has disappeared, you feel a natural sense of happiness. You feel happy because you have been a good person. You've been doing all the right things, thinking in the right way, acting in good ways, avoiding the bad stuff, being generous at every opportunity. You've done all of that. And then when you close your eyes, all those good acts come back to you. And this is what sila is all about. It's about all these actions coming back to you, enveloping you, surrounding you, suffusing you. You're suffused with all those good acts. And you can't avoid being happy anymore. This is what the Buddha is saying. You can't avoid happiness because it is so drenched inside of you. Isn't that a beautiful message? You know, you can't. It is so much part of you. And then he says that it's just like a mountain peak, right? There's a mountain peak, and then in the evening, the sun goes down behind the mountain. When the sun goes down behind the mountain, the shadow on the other side, it envelops and covers and overspreads the earth on the other side, right? Completely. It's a big mountain. So the shadow is kind of spread around. So our job in life is to make a mountain of good merit, a mountain of good action. And when we have a mountain of good action, then that shadow of the good action will enter our mind and it will overspread us, envelop us and cover us up. And we have no choice anymore to feel happiness. It's a pretty good deal, isn't it? No choice in feeling happy. That's the kind of deal I'm looking for. So that's why I find these kind of things so beautiful and such powerful similes. So there you are. Okay. Non-Buddhist. Okay, this is from a question from a non-Buddhist. So are you going to ask me to convert to a different religion? Okay, just 1 second. Let's grab a little bit of water. Okay. Even though I'm a non-Buddhist, I'm greatly interested in meditation and the way of life it dictates. I do not believe in the afterlife, but would you say that the experience in the present dictates all our actions, even ones that you can't understand? I would say that a lot of our experiences in the present are dictated by our present life. I think that is fairly common. You know, I was born in Norway. When I go back to Norway, they give me this weird food, right? For you, it's probably really strange. It's kind of strange kinds of fish, all these kind of things. And you probably say, yuck, what is all that all about? But I love it, right? And sometimes I go abroad and people give me strange food. I think, what is that? But they love it because they have been brought up in that culture. So it's a very simple way of understanding how that we are conditioned, right? When in our monastery in Perth, we have a very international community. People from all kinds of backgrounds come to our monastery. We have the Sri Lankans, you know, the Sri Lankan community in Perth, which actually is quite large. We have the Thai community in Perth, the Chinese community in Perth, the Western Buddhist in Perth, some Cambodians, some Laotian, some Vietnamese, and everybody comes and everybody brings their kind of food, right? This is how it is. This is how it works, because that's what we understand and what we appreciate. So just look at that in your own life, and I think you will find that the experience in this life are very, very important. But they don't explain everything here. And this is one of the things I started to understand quite early on when I became a Buddhist. In my early 20s, I was 21 years old. I was at university at the time studying engineering, and I got this opportunity to go abroad. They had this exchange program with engineering students around the world. And they said to me that, well, you know, we have this opening to go to Japan. And I thought, yeah, I always wanted to go to Asia, right? I always wanted to go to Asia. Why did I want to go to Asia? I didn't have any Asian friends. I didn't know anyone who was Buddhist, right? I didn't know anything about Asia, really, but there was this urge. I want to go to Asia. So Japan was the opportunity, so I went to Japan. And then when I went to Japan, of course, I went to the monasteries, right? The Zen monasteries in Japan. I met many Buddhist people while I was there. And I read my first book on Buddhism while I was there. And it's like, wow, there's something familiar about this. This makes sense. I understand this. What's going on here? Something inside of you, kind of stirring, right? You know that there's something familiar about this. And then later on, I went back to the university again. And one of my friends, he gave me a book about meditation, right? He said, here, read this. This is good. This will be good for you. Maybe he thought I was a bit restless or something. I don't know. Anyway, this will be good for you. Read this. So I read this book, a book called The Calm Technique, about breath meditation. I did some breath meditation, and I got some good results. And then I always wondered, why is it that I became a Buddhist? Why is it that I was leaning in that direction from so early on? I don't have any explanation from that. The only explanation I can think of is that I must have been a Buddhist in a past life. Perhaps I was living here in Colombo, right, in a past life. One of you guys. Perhaps there was some other Buddhist country. I don't know. I have no idea. But there's something very deep inside of me that told me that I kind of was a Buddhist already. When I was a child, I remember as a child, I had this idea I wanted to become a monk, right? Not a Buddhist monk, because I didn't know anything about Buddhism. I just wanted to be a monk somehow, living by myself in a Kamakuti somewhere. Where do these things come from? And I, of course, this is not a proof of rebirth at all. I fully appreciate that. But for me, because it's a personal experience, the only way I can explain it to myself is that it must come from a past life. So I would recommend you, even though you are not a Buddhist and you may not believe in rebirth, maybe you are atheist or whatever, I would recommend you to study this area quite in detail and have a look at it. I think there are some very strong and powerful arguments for why there is such a thing as rebirth. There are a lot of people in the world who are not Buddhists who believe in rebirth. Lots of Christians believe in rebirth. Lots of Muslims believe in rebirth. Lots of atheists believe in rebirth. Everybody basically believes in rebirth. but a small minority within that group. This is one of those interesting facts, I think, that you actually see around the world. So just because you're not a Buddhist doesn't mean that you have to reject the idea of rebirth. Okay. Venerable Sir, thank you for enlightening what a meditation retreat is. I have been to a retreat which was so strict and felt like coming home midway. Okay, yeah, that is not all that uncommon. Now I think of joining the retreat in Bandravela, if there are any vacancies. Can we accommodate? I don't know anything about what we can. What I have heard that is already full, but it's really not up to me to make these kind of decisions. So I don't know what the answer is. Bante, do you want to take this note? Yeah. Thank you. The answer is yes, we have space. Ah, okay. Okay, wonderful. We have space, apparently. So there you are. Good karma. You must have done something right in the past. That's really, really good. Okay, next question. How should me, my siblings, and my dad should act in the times when my mother gets mad? And how can we help her as a family to overcome this situation, which happens regularly? Okay. You have to be, when somebody goes mad, I guess you mean like a little bit crazy or whatever, you have to be very kind to them. It's a lot of suffering to go mad, right? It's very, very difficult. You have all these modern psychiatric illnesses like schizophrenia and bipolar disease and all these kind of things. And it is a lot of suffering. In some European countries, they now have these laws, euthanasia laws, where people are allowed to choose to die if they suffer too much. And sometimes if your mental illness is very strong, that is one of the grounds for allowing people to end their life. I'm not suggesting anything at all. I'm just saying that this is this is how bad. I'm just saying we should have a lot of compassion for people. That's my point. So please have compassion. The suffering is tremendous when these things happen. And once you understand that your mother is going through a very, very difficult time, and it's very difficult to be in that situation, and compassion arises, then you start to have so much more patience with her, right? So much more patience to deal with her problems and all the difficulties. And this is what it really is about. It's about understanding others. There's a beautiful saying in the French language. I don't know if you know any French, but it goes like this. If you know French, it says something like, tout comprendre, c'est tout pardonner. To understand all is to forgive all. If you are 100% in somebody else's shoes, you understand what it's like, then you can forgive them 100% because you understand why they are the way they are. So try to understand. This is always the most powerful thing here. And when you understand, you should hopefully be able to forgive and have compassion and do your best. If it becomes too much of a problem and too difficult, and if you have the means or whatever to get some professional help, I don't know, I'm not sure how that works here in Sri Lanka, but if there is that possibility, then that is also okay. It is not, we don't have to allow ourselves to be completely drowned, right, by other people's problems. Sometimes it's good to have a little bit of professional help, at least to help us overcome the difficult times. There's no point in having so much suffering ourselves that we're no longer able to help the other person. Okay. In Sri Lanka, much emphasis is placed on chanting, pujas, etc., while superstition is obviously not to be followed. What are your thoughts on Buddhist chanting? Any benefits? We just had a long discussion yesterday with somebody about this. Somebody came up to where I'm staying and he was complaining, oh, people chant too much, they don't know what they're chanting, and all these kind of things. But the important thing about anything we do in life is that it should be something which has some kind of positive effect on us. We shouldn't just chant because it is some kind of magic spell, right? Then it becomes really silly. If we just chant, oh, you know, like asking for a new car, or may it have some magic effect in my life or something like that, then it is not very good. But sometimes chanting can have benefits, right? And one of the benefits of chanting, even if you don't understand what is going on, you may feel peaceful as a consequence of chanting. You may feel a bit of happiness, right? If you are born as a Buddhist, maybe you have heard Buddhist chanting from a child. I know many Buddhists that I know, they feel precisely this because they hear it and they feel peaceful. So if you come back home after a long day and you feel a bit stressed and things aren't right, you would like to meditate but you feel a bit restless, and then you listen to a bit of Buddhist chanting. Perhaps you have a bit of Buddhist chanting on the radio or on a CD or whatever, and you listen to that and it makes you feel peaceful, then it's useful, right? Then you're using it in a good way because it's actually doing something good for you. That is one way of using Buddhist chanting here. Another way, which is even more powerful, is to actually understand what is going on. Try to understand what is being chanted. If you understand, for example, the Ittipiso Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuddho Vijja Charana Sampanno, if you understand that, you know, this is the recollection of the Buddha Anusati, if you understand what it means, it can give rise to joy, give rise to happiness, because you know the power of the Buddha and you're having this person as your teacher. Wow, isn't that wonderful? And then the chanting really comes alive when you start to understand what is going on. So if you're going to chant, I would recommend to chant the word of the Buddha, the suttas, right? The Ratana Sutta perhaps, or Mahamangala Sutta, the Metta Sutta, the Buddha Anusati recollections. Or it can be even longer suttas of the Buddha. I know some people sometimes chant things like the Satipatthana Sutta. But anyway, the point is, if you understand some of these suttas are very, very inspiring. And if you understand it, it becomes like a reflection on the Dhamma, a contemplation on the Dhamma. And this is so important, to contemplate the Dhamma. Once you contemplate it, it becomes much more powerful in your life. So that is what I recommend as far as chanting is concerned. Okay. Bhante, can you please recommend a good book which has the Buddhist suttas? There are many versions of the Tipitaka, but I am not sure which provides the Buddhist original trans-teachings. May you be blessed. Okay. If you want to read them in English, I know that there are Sinhala translations as well. I don't know what you prefer. Some people may prefer English. There are some nice English translations. And one of the best English translators is a monk called Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, who you may have heard about. He used to live here in Sri Lanka. He used to be the president of something called the Buddhist Publication Society in Sri Lanka. And he ran that for a large number of years. Now he's living in the US, and he is a very, very good translator. He's very careful, very meticulous, and those are the English translations I would recommend the most. And he has a book which is an anthology. It's a collection of suttas called In the Buddha's Words. In the Buddha's Words. It's an anthology. It collects suttas from different places, puts it all together very nicely. They are according to themes. And then he has introductions, he has footnotes, and explains what is going on. In the Buddha's Words is a very good one. So that is where I would start off. Beyond that, you can just get something like the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length sayings of the Buddha. If you want to read the word of the Buddha, there's four collections that you need to focus on. The Digha Nikaya, the long discourse of the Buddha, the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length discourse of the Buddha, the Sanyutta Nikaya, the connected discourse of the Buddha, and the fourth one is the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses. And of course, you can also read things like the Dhammapada, can be very inspiring. That is okay too. So this is where you should focus. In Sinhala translation, if you prefer that, I know that there are many translations into Sinhala as well. Sometimes I'm told that those translations are very hard to read because the language is incredibly lofty and it's very difficult for ordinary people to read it. But I believe that these days there are also translations available that are written in more ordinary language, so everybody should be able to read them. So I'm sure you can ask some of the monks here which translations that is. I have been told, this is just one example, but told that there is a very famous Sri Lankan monk called Kiribatgotnyanananda who has done translations. And apparently his translations are relatively easy to read. Some people have complained that they're not so accurate always, but at least they are easy to access. I'm just giving you as an example. I'm not really recommending because I don't actually know myself. I'm just saying from what I've heard from others. Okay, please give some references for suttas relevant to the Dhamma talk today. Okay, so I promised that while I was talking that you could ask for the references, and of course I shall be happy to do that. One of the most important references I was talking about was there is a sutta called in the Anguttara Nikaya, right, the numerical discourse of the Buddha. I don't know how much you know about the suttas, but if you know your suttas well, you will hopefully know what I'm talking about. Anguttara Nikaya is divided into nipatas, into chapters, from 1 to 11. The last chapter, chapter 11, the second sutta, is called Chaitana, intention. I think it's called Chaitana. Yes, Volish, yes, called Chaitana. And that is a sutta, that was my main reference in tonight's talk. And that particular sutta is found in similar ways in many, many places in the suttas. But that is one of the main places where it's found. So the second sutta of chapter 11 in the Anguttara Nikaya called Chaitana. And it shows you how one thing leads to the next one, starting with sila and then non-regret, pamuja, Piti, Pasaddi, Sukha, Samadhi, Yathabuddha, Nyanadasana, all the way up. And it shows you how this is not a result of willpower, but it is Dhammata. Dhammata means according with Dhamma, in accordance with nature. So that was the main sutta. So have a look at that one. It is, in my opinion, a very beautiful and nice sutta. Okay. So, okay. I am a person pretty much interested in spirituality and Buddhism. A few years ago, engaged in a meditation and felt the bliss and peace Buddhism is talking about. So I am strongly in to follow the Noble Eightfold Path, but my parents don't like me to follow religious things. Okay. And the marriage, I am being pushed into marriage by my parents. And the marriage, how could that affect my practice and the path? Okay. So, remember that, it is how you present the Buddhist teaching to your parents that really matters, right? If your parents understand that Buddhism and spirituality is about kindness, it's about compassion, it's about treating your parents well, right? Tell them that. It says in Buddhism, you should treat your parents well. If I'm not a Buddhist, maybe I won't treat you so well. See what they say then. It's very powerful. It actually is a very important part of Buddhist teaching, treating our parents in the right way. It happened, I just take you my own experience. You know, when I decided to become a Buddhist monk, my parents were not very impressed. Right? They said, what has gone wrong in the upbringing? Where have we failed? We have made a major mistake. You want to become a Buddhist monk? You had a good life. You have been well educated, everything. And now you want to become a Buddhist monk. What is this all about? And they were not very happy at all about this idea of becoming a Buddhist monk. And but I was sure this is what I wanted to do. So I, thought, okay, well, I'm not going to allow my parents to stop me. So I said, I want to do this. Please give me permission to become a monk. And being from a Western background, there's no way. They realize I have to do my own thing, right? So they said, yes, we give you permission to become a monk. Yeah. But they were not happy. They thought I was getting taken away into some kind of strange cult. They didn't know anything about Buddhism, basically. Yeah. But then, incredible transformation has happened over the years. And this is the amazing thing. I understood fairly early on that I was not going to be able to to teach my parents the Buddha's teachings. I wasn't going to be able to convert them into the Buddha's way by saying, listen, this is the Four Noble Truths. You must believe in this. That is not what I did, right? Instead, what I did was just say, okay, well, you know, just be myself. And not just be myself, but actually follow the Buddha's teachings in my dealing with my parents. To be kind to them, right? To be nice to them. To help them out if they need some help. And after a while, they start thinking, what's going on? You know, this rebellious son of ours, he's actually being nice to us. Something has happened here. And of course, that starts to open their heart. This is how people work. It opens their heart when you are kind and good towards them. But it took a long time. So after about 10 years as a monk, that's when I started to feel the big difference. I've been a monk for 20 years now. After about 10 years, that's when I started to feel the real difference. And eventually, now, whenever I go back to visit my family, they say, oh, please meditate with us. Teach us meditation. Which book should we be reading here? My father tells me, oh, I listen to your talks on the internet, right? Because my talks are available on the internet. My father is listening to my talks on the internet. It's just astonishing. Fathers don't do that sort of thing, but in this case, it's happening. Yeah. My father said to me, I used to be your teacher. Now you're my teacher. Right? So this is the power of this, the power of us doing what is right. So if your parents are not happy about these things, tell them about the basic foundations of the Buddhist path. Especially tell them through your actions and through the way you are. And gradually, if your parents understand that you are doing something that is good, something that has a positive effect on them, they will become overjoyous that you are a Buddhist. They will become overjoyous that you're doing something positive in the world, which has a positive effect on them, a positive effect on you, and lifts everybody else up. So sometimes you just have to be a bit stubborn, right? You have to know that I'm doing the right thing, and then carry on like that. As for marriage, I'm not sure if I'm very the right person to comment on that. But, you know, it depends how you want to live your life, right? If you don't feel ready to get married, I think you have the right to stand your ground. It is your life. You shouldn't allow your parents to push you into a marriage. If you don't want to be married, you should say no. We all need to be a little bit assertive sometimes, right? And that is the kind of assertion that you are allowed to have. Is that this is something for the rest of your life, right? And you're going to be pushed into something you don't want to do. It is not a good thing here. So I think that you have the right to stand up. But if you stand up, do it in a nice way. Say to your parents, I'm not ready yet. Don't say, I never want to get married, because then they might go, oh, that's too much for them. Say, I'm not ready yet. You don't know. Maybe in a few years' time you want to get married. These things change all the time. So just be honest. I'm not ready yet. Please, please, mother and father, please don't push me. You know, if I'm not ready, it may lead to so much suffering for me. Appeal to your parents' compassion. Appeal to your parents' understanding. Say it in a nice way. Don't be confrontational. Say it in a way whereby you can give rise to good qualities in your parents. In this way, slowly, 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 you will be able to turn your parents around. And one day, they are likely to be very proud of you, just like my parents are now very proud of me. They will be very proud of you and say, wow, you know, you did the right thing here. You've been doing what you should be doing here. Okay. Is there any difference of jhana explained in Buddhism and in Hinduism? There is a difference in jhana. For every person you ask, there's a difference in jhana. The problem is that the Buddha teaches about the jhanas, right? You see this in the suttas. It's everywhere in the suttas. It's a very important part of the Buddhist path. It's in the Noble Eightfold Path. Jhanas is there everywhere. And then, so the Buddha taught the jhanas, but then we have to try to understand what is it that the Buddha taught. And this is where it gets complicated, and people have different ideas, different feelings. This is what we mean by interpretation of the Buddha's teachings. It is very, it is fraught and it's difficult. And really the only way to know is to one day get there yourself and then experience those things. And then you start to understand what these deep states of meditation are about. And I think that there are people in Hinduism, I think, that probably also get these deep states of meditation. You read about some of the Hindu sages, and it's astonishing the kind of meditation they seem to have. Right? So they also, I think, at least some of them, probably not many, because these things are very rare, but some of them are likely to also get similar kind of states. But remember, it is not just about jhana, it's also about the view that we have. And the problem for somebody who has been brought up in Hinduism or Christianity or Islam or any other religion is that they have a view of reality that is very different from the Buddhist view. And that view of reality is a view that there is a creator God, right? There is Mahabrahma, for example, in Hinduism, and Mahabrahma and the world. Mahabrahma is an eternal, permanent kind of essence of the universe, right? Brahma. In Christianity and Islam, they have the idea of a creator God that created the world, who is also permanent, always there. But in Buddhism, we don't really believe in that kind of permanent God. And this is the essence of right view, the very beginning of right view, the idea of karma and rebirth, and things just going along according to causes and conditions. So the problem is that jhana is good to have deep meditation, of course. But the problem is that if you start off with a wrong view, then that wrong view will also have an effect on that jhana experience. And that is why samadhi, right samadhi in Buddhism, is both jhana together with the right view. If you don't have the right view, it becomes problematic, and that is going to block you, or at least it may block you, from going even further on the path. Okay, so we are coming to the end. So, okay. You spoke about how forgiveness can be reached thinking about the causation of that action. But when you consider the way society works, and especially the judicial system, a negative action directly results in punishment. When I was contemplating this, as a prospective barrister, I wanted to know how one can forgive through the causation system but still adhere to the justice system we are living in. Yes, that is true. It is, of course, this is actually part of karma, as it is explained in Buddhism, that if you do bad things, you get punished as a consequence. This is part of what karma is all about. So yes, negative action tends to lead to bad results. And this is, this is how our society works. And as a judge, I think if you are applying the system in a fair way, if you try to understand the person, and you try to understand why they're doing what they're doing, and then sometimes punishment is not necessarily a bad thing as such. The punishment isn't a bad thing. Sometimes you need that to learn a little bit, right? Even within the Sangha, within the monastic community, if you do something that is completely against the monastic rules, you can be expelled. Right? And expulsion is a kind of punishment, you could say. Or if you do something which isn't quite that bad, you can still have to do all kinds of things. You won't get physically punished, but you will have to do other things which are humiliating for you, because you have done something bad according to the monastic rules. And I think the same thing with society. You know, if you go to prison or whatever, you may not be physically punished, but you have to go to prison as a consequence of your bad actions. And I think that is not necessarily a bad thing. You can still understand that this has happened to the person according to conditionality. You can still forgive the actions, But you understand that our society will fall apart unless we have a system which has some sort of punishment, perhaps. Ideally, the kind of punishment we should have, and I think this is an important point also from a Buddhist point of view, the ideal kind of punishment, the ideal kind of prison sentence is a prison sentence which rehabilitates people, right? You get rehabilitated. You understand that you made a mistake. People help you to change your outlook so that you become a good person instead. And this is some of the best prison systems in the world are actually very good at rehabilitating people. It means that when they come back into society after serving the prison sentence, they actually function as proper members of society. They don't just go back and become criminals again. In societies where rehabilitation is very bad, people usually stay in prison. As soon as they come out, they go back into the criminal circles and they start doing the bad things again. I think these are the kind of Buddhist attitude is, well, we should help these people, right? They are really lost. We should have compassion on them. Maybe a short time in prison will be good, especially if that can help to rehabilitate them, to become responsible members of society. If that is how it works, then it's great. Then the prison system may actually do something positive. So prison in itself, or a little bit of punishment in itself, is not necessarily bad. I think we should avoid too much physical punishment, but certainly at some time in prison may not necessarily be a bad thing. If we can avoid punishment altogether and still rehabilitate the person, even better, I think. Yeah. But this is up for society at large to decide. Oh, okay. Venerable Bhante, many merits. I am unhappy with my marriage. I've been married for 5 years, but right now I am staying with him just for my parents and societies. What should I do? I have tried to explain to parents and my husband, but they don't get it. Yes. This is how many people have it, and that is why, of course, we have divorce rates are often going up, and things are, you know, this is what happens. Married life can often be difficult. I don't know how difficult your married life is. It varies in degrees, right? And sometimes it can be incredibly difficult. Sometimes, like, you can get physically abused and all these kind of things. Then it is really, really bad. So it depends on the degrees. Well, there is two ways of dealing with difficulties in life. Because there are difficulties wherever you go. And sometimes the difficulty is actually sometimes in the person themselves. So I know people who go from job to job and they say, after every job, they say, oh, the job is so hard, they're treating me unfairly, they go to a new one, they have the same feeling again, and it goes on and on and on. And sometimes the problem can actually be solved better by looking inside of yourself. What can I do to change? This is what I have experienced in my life. I have tried when I have seen difficulties in my life. I've never been married, so I can't really relate to this particular thing. But when there is a problem, can I change my outlook? Can I change my perspective? Can I have more compassion? Can I have more understanding? Can I deal with the situation in a certain way? And I've always found that if I'm able to work on myself, my own perceptions, why is it that I feel suffering here? And look at the situation in the new way. That is when I grow the most in the Dhamma. I grow because I learn how to accept other people for what they are, to understand the world in a new way, to understand people in a new way. It develops compassion and understanding inside of you. So that is one way of doing it. Another way is if you are really unhappy and you find that this is not the solution, and sometimes things can just be too hard, right, and too difficult. And sometimes it is okay also to get a divorce. It is not against the Buddha's teachings to get a divorce if things are very, very hard. But it is something that you have to decide for yourself. Don't kind of jump to any kind of decision one way or the other. Look very carefully one way or the other. Talk with some of your Buddhist friends, right? Sometimes you parents and your husband, they have too much vested interest. They can't really see what's going on. Ask some of your Buddhist friends. Have a chat with them. See what they think, right? And ask them, what do you think I should do? Should I try harder or should I get a divorce? How should I deal with this particular situation? But you have no obligation from a Buddhist point of view to stay in any kind of relationship which is so detrimental to you that it kind of drags you down. That is what you find. There's no obligation there. Anyway, that's just my suggestions without really knowing too much about these kind of things. Okay. I attended a 10-day meditation retreat, Vipassana retreat. After relaxing the body, we focus on the breath and watch the tingling sensations run through the body. It takes some effort to watch the sensations move. That's one. Sometimes we feel sharp pains and we're asked to watch till it goes away, and it eventually does. We were told this is how sankharas come out. Is this technique correct? There is no such thing as a technique which is correct or wrong. Maybe there are in certain cases. It is always the result of the technique which makes the technique either right or wrong. So what result are you getting? If the results that you are getting, especially in the long run, over a long period of time, if you're getting good results, and you find that over the long run, the good mental states are increasing, the bad mental states are going down, you are going somewhere, your meditation is improving, if that is what is happening over the long period, then it is a method that works, right? It works in a certain way. So don't think of a method as either right or wrong. It is the result of the method that actually tells you whether something is right or wrong. That is a very useful piece of advice because it means that you can look at your life and you can take charge of your own growth. If you know what you're supposed to look for, you can take charge of what kind of meditation you want to do, what kind of practice you want to do as a consequence of that. There is, I think I recognize what technique this is. You don't have to say it out because these have all the characteristics of a particular technique. This idea that sankharas come out, this is the idea that you're kind of burning off your karma by experiencing pain. That's basically the idea. Sankhara and karma are very closely related to each other. Sankhara means volitional actions. So these are the actions that lead to the building up of karma. The idea here is that if you sit with a pain, it's like you are burning off the karma. That's really the idea here. And to be honest with you, it is not a Buddhist idea. It's not an idea you find in the suttas. This is a Jain idea. You still find Jain ascetics in India the present day, and the Jains have this idea that if you burn off your karma, then eventually you will reach liberation in that way. It's not actually a Buddhist way. So the idea that somehow will burn off your karma, I think that it is not really the way the Buddhas the Buddha looked at this. That doesn't mean the technique may still work, but I think that that idea is not the right one. So you have to ask yourself, is it giving results? Is it not? If it is too painful and you don't want to do this technique anymore, it doesn't give results, then is the right time to switch to something else. Personally, I'm not a fan of pain. I don't really think a lot of pain is useful. That's just my personal perception of this. And as I said before, I think that fits quite well with how the Buddha taught the path. Last question. Okay. Good. What is the simplest form of life in which vijnana exists? Out of the living beings we see around us, what is the simplest form that is involved in samsara? For example, ants, flies, microorganisms, etc. Okay. This is a very difficult question, and it's very hard to know exactly where the barriers and the limits of life are. In Buddhism, we talk about pana tipata, you know, the destruction of life. Pana, which is here the word for life, means the breath, right? So one way of looking, one answer to that question is that any being that breathes, any being that has lungs, you know, that is still within samsara. Once you go below the kind of capacity for ordinary breathing, then perhaps you don't have any consciousness anymore. But I'm not sure about that. This is just a guess, because even a microorganism, even though they don't have lungs, they still take in oxygen, right? Just in a different way. It's just another way of breathing, in a sense. So the answer is very, very uncertain. And I think that you just have to go with common sense, right? And common sense to me is that if you can see an animal, if an animal is there, if it is like a small insect that is within, that you can actually see with a physical eye, then I would say if you kill it on purpose, that is always going to be bad karma. When it comes to things like bacteria and viruses and these kind of things, I think that I cannot say this for sure, but I don't feel particularly bad if I kill a virus. If I take a medicine for killing a virus, it doesn't leave me with a bad conscience afterwards. So I just use my personal experience to say, okay, probably there is very, very little bad karma, if anything at all, involved with that. But remember the idea of karma here. The karma is not always black or white. Very often karma is something in between, right? So sometimes when you do an act like that, like killing a virus, you also have to have compassion for yourself as well. To go around with an illness over a long period of time doesn't make any sense. So sometimes we have to do things which may be neither bad karma nor good karma, but somewhere in between. That is roughly how I would regard these things. And I don't think there is any absolute answer to those things. Maybe eventually, perhaps science will be able to come to a final answer, and they will tell us where there is consciousness, where there isn't. At the moment, I think science is still a long way from discovering these things, but hopefully, maybe one day, it will find these things out. Okay, so that is the last question. Thank you very much.
Venerable sir, on behalf of every single one of us present here today, we'd like to thank you very much for spending your knowledge and your time with us. And for all of us here in Sri Lanka today, it was certainly a meaningful poem morning, well spent and well learned. Thank you very much once again for being with us here today. Friends, would you please remain in your seats? Bante will leave now. He's got to go for his afternoon dhani. So please remain seated until he leaves the hall.